Jeffrey Williams is a prisoner. If Texas has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison workers are getting ready to execute Williams by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, which carries out more than one-third of all U.S. executions. Williams' execution would be the 498th in Texas during the modern era, a record no other state comes close to matching. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, the criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Richard Dieter, executive director of a death penalty nonprofit that recently cast Harris County, home of the city of Houston, as the epicenter of the U.S. death penalty. The execution watch for Jeffrey Williams begins.
Good evening, this is Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch on KPFT HD Channel 3. Unfortunately, we have business tonight. Texas is executing Jeffrey Williams tonight, and that is going on pretty much as we talk here. Gloria Rubeck is standing by in Huntsville to give us the chat. Gloria, are you there?
I'm here. The media has gone in. I haven't seen any family members go in, and I actually don't know if there are any. But the Houston police are acting, I guess, like men do. They're down the street revving up their motorcycles so loud that I'm having to walk down the block. I guess that's a show of their manhood or something.
Well, no, actually, let me explain to the audience. Jeffrey Williams was convicted of killing a Houston police officer, and the legal authorities on the execution watch are going to sort through that. There at least was some question as whether or not, since the police officer was not in uniform and not driving a marked car, about the culpability of that issue. That'll be discussed. And another thing we were discussing is whether or not the truancy of the EMT team might not have been a homicide at all if there had been adequate first responder issues. So all that. But every time someone is executed who has killed a police officer, you and I remember this from the Billy Hughes case and others, There is always an orgy of police action going on simultaneously with the execution. That event does not happen when other people are executed, but if it involves a police officer, there's kind of a demonstration orgy over the other side. How many people are there to demonstrate opposed to this execution?
Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of us.
Is there any indication that any of them are directly connected to Jeffrey Damone Williams?
No, there's not.
Okay.
This is the first time I've seen the police acting so stupid where they're quieted up now, but all of a sudden they all got on their motorcycles and revved them up to the point I couldn't hear the person next to me.
Gloria, probably the most dependable audience Execution Watch has is Houston police officers. They turn on Execution Watch when we're on broadcast and cuss at their radios. That should not be a surprise to you.
Well, I know that men like their toys, but this startled everybody standing out here, including Mary Benton from Channel 2. We were all trying to figure out what was that noise.
Gloria, while I've got you on the phone, at least the media witnesses across the street, so I can announce to the audience that apparently the process is continuing as planned. We're getting close to the end of the legislature. Is there anything that you're aware of, positive or negative, coming out of this session of the legislature?
Well, I think the one good thing, and hopefully Rick Perry will sign it, but it's on his desk, what's being called the Michael Morton bill, which says that the prosecutors need to open up their files. That would prevent Michael Morton from spending 25 years in prison. It would have prevented Anthony Haynes from being on death row and spending 18 years in prison. And who knows what else? Nathaniel Barley, who had been on death row, unfortunately he died of cancer, but much later his attorneys found pictures in the DA's file.
And the DA, that's very DA, is before a court even as we speak.
In the Michael Morton case?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah. They need to put his butt in jail, like ASAP.
And his name has shown up before because he was appointed to the Forensic Evidence Commission.
Well, now that was John Bradley. It was Bradley's boss, I think, whose name escapes me at the moment.
Oh, okay.
It was Williamson County, just north of Dallas.
Right. No, William County, just north of Austin. That's Georgetown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that county has been doing the bidding of those who are on the other side of this issue from all of us for a long time.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, so, Gloria.
You know, I don't think any witnesses, unless I missed them running away from the motorcycles. I didn't see any witnesses for the Williams.
Well, give
Williams our family.
Give our regards to the other vigilants there, and call us if something else happens.
Okay.
Thank
All
you,
right.
Gloria.
Uh-huh. Oh, and you know what, Ray?
Yeah.
One thing that I wanted to ask you to ask Dick Dieter when you talked to him, we were just talking with the AP reporter and the Houston Chronicle reporter and the Professor Longmire from the university about the cost of executions. In Texas, the latest survey was done in 1992 by the Dallas Morning News, and it said it was 2.3 or 3.2 million.
Yeah.
We figured out at our last meeting that Texas has spent over $1 billion for 500 executions.
Well,
I'm just curious if there's any more recent studies.
I'll
and
see
maybe
if
Mr. Dieter knows.
I'll see if the professor has put those figures to pencil. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Gloria Rubeck of the Death Penalty Abolition Movement. And you can find her on the Internet at abolitionmovement.org. Just if you put abolition movement in your search engine, that ain't going to work. So go to the real thing and put www.abolitionmovement.org, and that way you can get there. Jim, what happened in this case?
As you said earlier, it's the death of a policeman. What happened? There was a 30-year-old Houston police officer named Tony Blando, and he was driving through a parking lot of a hotel looking for stolen cars. And he was driving a Jeep Cherokee and was dressed in civilian clothes. And apparently, according to the evidence, they claimed that he had one of those badges around his neck you often see with the chain. He checked his Lexus and discovered that the Lexus had been stolen in what they call an armed robbery.
By checking, you probably put the
license plate.
But I'm going to hold up there because
sure.
We've got Dave. Dave, are you there?
I am here, Ray.
All right. Where is here, Dave?
We are at the corner of Bissonnette, Benz, and Main Street by St. Paul's United Methodist Church and across from the museums.
And how many vigilants have you there?
We've got 11 people out here today.
Good.
So pretty good turnout.
I need to report that although there doesn't appear to be any family witnesses in this execution, the media have crossed the road, so
yeah.
The process is proceeding.
Yeah.
And I, while you're on the phone, Dave, your organization is active in things legislative, and we're reaching the end of this legislative session. Thumbs up, thumbs down, doesn't make any difference. What's the report?
Well, there has been a hearing on the bill introduced by Jessica Farrar to abolish the death penalty, and we had Anthony Graves testify and a few other people. And so, just to get the hearing is good. I have not heard anything positive from the hearing that we're going to, get a vote. You got to get out of the calendars committee after you, even when you get out of the committee, and then it's going to come to the House for the vote. I have not heard that anything is working there, unfortunately. But we did get a hearing. I heard that, I was not there actually, but I heard that Anthony Graves did a fantastic job in, talking, why we should abolish the death penalty. And, so, you know, I guess it's slow progress is the best way I can describe things, right now. This is such a tough state to abolish the death penalty in, and with the makeup of the legislature and the governor, but, you know, you gotta just keep doing it every time. Every time there's a legislative session, you have to get out there, you have to state your story, and eventually we're gonna be successful. It may be, who knows, it may be the Supreme Court will finally make the decision for Texas. I don't know. But, we have to always be out there telling why we think the death penalty should be abolished, and eventually I am really confident that we are going to get rid of the death penalty in Texas.
Dave, I want to thank you very much. I want you to give our regards to the other vigilants, and I'll tell the people right now that if you want to know more about Dave and his organization, you can go to tcdap.org, right?
I'm having a little hard time, but it's tcadp, Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
TCA.org.
TCAADP.org.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Ray. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
And that was Dave. David's been active with the abolition movement. Dave Atwood has been active with the end of death penalty for a long time. I'm sorry.
No problem.
The officer was cruising, and I understand from previous discussion that this is kind of a gathering place for hookers and pimps. Is that?
Well, it's over off the Southwest Freeway. If you recall, that area's kind of gone downhill next to the old Colorado Club, the strip club.
Yeah.
And it was what they would characterize as a high crime area. You know, everybody in that neighborhood, not everybody, but a substantial number of hookers and drug dealers and things like that, is a bad neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, like I say, he was in plain clothes driving a Jeep Cherokee, and he got a hit on this. So when Lexus hit me.
By hit, he looked up the license tag and back.
Right. And so what happened, he didn't, this is a good question, he didn't call for backup. He gets out with his gun drawn, attempts to arrest the driver of the Lexus. Two witnesses say the driver of the Lexus identified as being Williams. They got into an argument. Williams did not want to be handcuffed. The officer put one handcuff on Williams, and according to the testimony, Williams swung around and drew a gun and shot the officer in the chest and took off running. The officer managed to get back to his car and radioed for help. And then they arrested Williams a short distance away. He's still wearing one handcuff. But what was interesting, he was also carrying the 9mm gun that was used in that shooting, plus he'd been used in a prior robbery. But what was interesting, when they went to the scene, there were guns, cartridges from three different guns that were fired. So the officer shot back at Williams as apparently somewhat of a shootout, but there are also three guns used, but only found one in the officer's gun. But nonetheless, what happened, it's, they identified him as being the shooter. He was picked up immediately at the scene wearing one handcuff. And then he was interrogated. Of course, what they always say, he was given Miranda warnings, agreed to talk, and gave two different written statements. And one of the written statements, he claimed that he didn't know that the man who was approaching him was a police officer. He thought he was being robbed because of the neighborhood. And he didn't know he was being robbed, and that's what he said in one of the statements. And he did not testify at trial. But what they did introduce, of course, was all the testimony I just mentioned before, plus they introduced all the information that came from the what they call the data terminal, the recorders and everything the police officer reported in. And there wasn't much. The only issue at guilt or innocence was whether he knew as a police officer. Otherwise, there's no question that Williams shot somebody, and there's no question he admitted that. His defense, and at least through the confession, was he didn't know the man was a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
The guilt was, like I say, that was the only issue at guilt or innocence.
And, of course, in the case of shooting a police officer, you've got two things. You've got to either show that he knew that he was a police officer.
And the officer's performance of his duty.
And the officer's performance of his duty. And unlike other capital cases, it doesn't have to be during the commission of crime.
No. They just have to show that he knew as a police officer, lawful performance is the word they use, lawful performance of his duty, that equals capital murder.
Why is the officer in uniform? Is he working an off-duty security job?
You know, I never found that. I looked in the opinion. They never said he's working off-duty. It sounds like it, though. He's driving a Jeep Cherokee, and I can't imagine. We were discussing this earlier with our lawyers, and we couldn't imagine why in the world he was on duty, what he was doing driving a civilian car and civilian
clothing.
Well,
I mean, if the vice squad is going to do an undercover operation in an area like that and bust hookers, they frequently drive independent cars. They don't necessarily wear their badges around their neck on their chest because they're trying to get somebody to solicit them and then make an arrest. So if he was on duty undercover capacity, he might be driving a civilian
car. Yeah, but usually stolen cars don't solicit you.
That's true.
That's the difference I can see between the two, because in this case, he's just driving through a parking lot, and it could have very well, a police officer could have done the same thing without alerting a whole lot of interest or publicity. But anyway, I've asked Susan to talk about the punishment part, because guilt or innocence is simple. Did he know as a policeman? That's pretty simple.
Yeah. Okay, Susan, and what was brought up during sentencing?
Well, at punishment, his mother testified, and basically his mother testified that he came from a pretty good home. His mother and father had been married for 25 years. His parents had stable employment. The family was, shall we say, sounded like they were fairly middle class, economically stable. The family went to church. Basically, the mother said that from her testimony that he was a slow learner, that she tried to help him with his homework and she helped him with his schoolwork and homework. She said that as he got into high school, that he started to have emotional problems and she started to suspect something wasn't quite right with him. And he began to break into lockers and steal mail and things like that. There were also church members from the church the family had gone to that also testified. And basically the church members really said that he was polite, that he was reserved, but he was a loner. And he didn't really connect with other teens his age, that he would do something if people asked him to do it, but he wasn't really outgoing. He didn't really form relationships with other teens, you know, in the congregation his age, so you could say he was a loner. He did, after high school, he went into the Navy, and he got a discharge under honorable conditions, a general discharge under honorable conditions. So what I've learned is that's not an honorable discharge, that he apparently...
Yeah, he was basically asked to leave.
Right. He did not adapt to, you know, what was expected of him in the Navy, and he was, shall we say, let go, so to speak. When he was in the ninth grade, there was an intelligence, an IQ test given to him. He was tested, and his verbal IQ, which was tested apparently at 79, his performance level IQ was 65. So I guess they averaged it to 70, but, you know, so he was what you would characterize probably as slow. And there was no doubt he was slow, clearly coming from his mother and other people that, you know, testified.
Would that have ordinarily been a factor in the case?
I guess you can interpret that. Different people could interpret it different ways. On the issue of future dangerousness, some people may feel that slow is less dangerous than somebody that's retarded. Other people may see it differently. I think they probably put on evidence that he came from a pretty good family, probably to try to show that, you know, good families can have problem children or children that don't come out right, that maybe he went off the deep end.
Now, this case was pre-Atkins.
Yes.
So this case would be pre-Atkins. So the deal is that you're not trying to find some fine, obscure point of law and hit it. You're trying to deal with the impression of the jury about the client as applied to the case?
I mean, he also did have employment. He did complete the 12th grade. So he completed high school. He might have been slow, but he completed the 12th grade. He also had a job. He had a job as a delivery, driving, I guess, a delivery vehicle for an auto parts store. Mm-hmm. And he was also a night stockman in a warehouse
for
a while.
So he was able to adapt to, like, useful things.
He obviously was able to adapt well enough to have a certain amount of employment. Although he clearly was probably socially not normal, that he didn't, basically the evidence was that he was a loner.
Okay, that gets us to the trial phase. There are two parts of a capital trial. One is deals with guilt or innocence. The other deals with the level of punishment, which is basically a thumbs up or a thumbs down, isn't it? It's
yeah.
either life or death.
One thing I want to mention to answer your question, what happened, they argued, Donald Davis is a lawyer that defended him.
And you know this lawyer.
I know lawyer Donald well. And one of the things they yelled about on writs is they claimed that they should have developed the mental retardation issue better at punishment. That was one of their major issues after the Atkins case came out. Of course, they claimed mental retardation at the writ level. And Larry's going to discuss that. But they did make a big issue out of the fact that the lawyer was ineffective at punishment for not developing the mental retardation issue. They argued that on appeal.
And so the deal in this particular case is that it would be an argument among lawyers whether or not you would develop the mental retardation case.
To see if that would mitigate, see if a jury would be impressed not to give the death penalty, thought he might be a little slow. That would be the only way. That's what they argued.
Yeah, but this is pre-Atkins.
Right, pre-Atkins.
So all you're talking about here is what impression do you make on a sitting jury?
Exactly.
It's kind of ethereal stuff one way or the other, isn't it?
Really, it's a desperate attempt from writ writers to try to
argue that. Don't writ attorneys kind of have to paint the trial attorneys with a bad brush?
They always do.
That's kind of their job, and that's not necessarily surprise or make professional enemies out of people.
Well, you have two enemies, I've often said, when you try a capital case, writ writers in the state. So.
I mean, he did complete the 12th grade.
Yeah.
So I think it is a little, he might have been slow, but one can be slow and still manage
to
complete.
Well, I barely made it out too, Susan.
He can complete the 12th grade. I think it's a little bit, it's going to be a little difficult to try to argue that he's completely retarded if he completed the 12th grade and he had two, shall we say, jobs, two functioning jobs.
Okay. Is Richard Dieter on the line? No.
No.
Okay. We were expecting a call from Richard Dieter. What's the can begin?
He's gonna call. He's gonna call.
Okay, he's gonna call. Okay, so we're waiting on Richard to call in.
I mean, I think what the attorney was trying to do is show that he was emotionally disturbed from his teen years, that from then on he had emotional problems and he was emotionally disturbed, that he was a loner and emotionally disturbed.
Okay, I appreciate the fine work of the wonderful lawyers on Execution Watch, but we got Mr. Dieter on the telephone. Mr. Dieter, Richard.
Yes, hello.
Hello, glad to have you on Execution Watch. I'm sorry you are joining us at a sad point. They're killing someone tonight.
Yes.
And we're trying to cover that. You have recently released some very interesting statistics, which makes the city in which I am now sitting like ground zero.
Yes.
For Execution Watch. In the first place, why did you do this study, and is this the work of a study that is distributed professionally, or is this a book?
Well, for a long time, everyone has looked at the death penalty with respect to what states have it and what states don't, and some states have a lot of executions and some have none at all. But we decided to look more closely at the counties within the states, and both with respect to who's on death row, which executions are being carried out, which death sentences are handed down, and found, perhaps to no one's surprise, that it's very clustered. It's very isolated to a few areas. It's not that the whole state uniformly carries out the death penalty or applies it or uses it. but rather it tends to be in many states, just a few counties, and that's true around the country as well.
And were you surprised at how few those counties were?
No, not. We had seen some research like this earlier, but I think it's the first time everybody on death row has a county assigned. Some states have done this. But we've known for some time that the death penalty is largely a political phenomena. That is that it's not the normal part of the criminal justice system where people have offenses, get sentences, and that's pretty much across the state. But rather, the death penalty is the fruit of a particular philosophy of a prosecutor, and that may be entirely different across the county line. So you get all kinds of death sentences, and of course, death sentences eventually mean executions in one county, and nothing in the other county. And it turns out most counties in the United States, most counties even in death penalty states, do not use the death penalty. The U.S. is considered a death penalty country, but most of our counties, most of our states do not have executions, do not have death sentences in a particular year, do not have anybody on death row. So it's, of course, it is something that we all pay for. The costs get distributed around the state, but the use of the death penalty is rather isolated.
You mean to tell me that Harris County, who apparently holds the current record in this state for executions, it doesn't cost the taxpayer of Harris County any more money than it costs the taxpayers throughout the state to do that?
Well, that's a good point. Good question. Counties are generally responsible for some of the trial work, so, appointing a defender. But when it comes to, a state prosecutor or when it comes to all the appeals, that's the attorney general's or the, state appellate offices or that are defending these cases, death row. A lot of the death penalty occurs after the trial, and even some of the trial expenses are borne by taxpayers across the state. So, yes, taxpayers in Harris County pay more because they have a lot of trials, but everybody around the state pays part of the cost of the death penalty in Harris County.
Do you actually think that in those counties where the executions are not as numerous that the county considers the cost to them of the cost of doing
this? No, I think that, this gets sort of subsumed in some budget and people are not sent the bill for the executions that occur as a result of Harris County cases. if they did, I think that this would be a different scenario. So these costs are kind of foisted on, as I say, most of the state, most of the country, without their sort of buying into it. As a matter of fact, they, might have elected a prosecutor who doesn't seek the death penalty, or they might have jurors who don't impose death sentences, thinking that that's the end of the story. But they're really paying, or they're really part of a state system that happens in a few pockets, and those pockets, the costs are borne, much of it is borne by the whole state.
In looking over your statistics, I found a lot of material there that indicated that the people waiting to be executed is from whence you got the numbers. Do you think it's significant that no one was sentenced to death row from Harris County last year?
Yes. Of course, Harris County used to be a reliable county for lots of death sentences, and of course still has executions, still leads the country in terms of numbers of executions since 1976, over 100 from Harris County. But new death sentences, no, not so much. And what that says is that even a county can change depending on the philosophy of the district attorney, which emphasizes the arbitrariness of the system. In other words, it's not a uniform law that Texas applies. It's a law that some prosecutors believe should be implemented frequently and get as many executions or death sentences, and others don't either can't afford, their county can't afford it, or they don't believe, you know, these cases. So there are many counties in Texas have nobody from death row, nobody executed. And those tends to be actually the majority. So the fact that it can change like this from, you know, say 10 years ago to the present, even within a county, shows how dependent it is on one person.
Well, I kind of cheated. I looked at your map knowingly as a Texan, and there is a concentration in Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth of executions. Then the other major urban cities kind of kicked in. Then when you start looking at the rural cities or rural towns, rural counties, I noticed that most of those occur in counties where there are prisons, and I wonder if the presence of a prison in a rural county would have any statistical difference on the capital cases coming out of that county.
Well, it's an interesting conjecture. We haven't looked at it. I've lived in a town with a big prison, and I do know that a lot of people who were in the town worked in the prison, and that those people, you know, they're mixed in their views, but they do tend to be more accepting of the state's position and believing the law enforcement is correct in its prosecutions and evidence, et cetera. So, you can't paint too broad a picture just on, you know, feelings
you can't jump to too many conclusions.
You have to look at it more, but, you know, there could be a correlation. I can say that there has been some connections have been made between places that seek the death penalty a lot and cases that get reversed a lot. A lot of mistakes are being made in these counties. It's not that they are good at it. They often get overturned.
On appeals.
Yes.
The last figures that we were able to come up here were from the late 90s, of what it actually cost to execute someone in the state of Texas system. Do you have any newer figures in that?
You know, I don't have them for Texas. The state really has to do their own study. It'd be hard to get all the, you know, the relevant information from somebody from the outside. But it's clearly a lot more than it used to be. I think in some ways, Texas has made some improvements. They're paying lawyers where they didn't used to pay them for parts of the appeal. They're requiring more experience from defense lawyers, and so those lawyers cost more. They're allowing, you know, some more testing or experts, you know. So the death penalty in Texas, whatever the cost was in the 90s, I think it was a couple million dollars per case. Are more now. There's no question that the costs have gone up all over the country. California, they are spending over $180 million a year on the death penalty, and they've got the largest death row, so they have one claim to largeness in the death penalty. Texas has the largest number of executions. But both are indicative of a lot of use of the death penalty. So I don't know exactly, but with close to 1,000 death sentences, but certainly between 800 death sentences that Texas has imposed, maybe as many as...
And there is a current trend among some states to eliminate capital punishment within their state borders. I mean, this is kind of getting to be like the same-sex marriage business.
It's amazing because there were no states that took that route, and so there's a correlation, I guess, with what you were just saying. From the 1980 to 2007, there was no states taking that kind of vote. But since 2007, there's been six states, and I think it's the conclusion that the death penalty in those states for those people wasn't working, and was costing them a lot. And I live in Maryland. We had one county, Baltimore County, is like almost all the death sentences were coming from there.
Yeah.
Baltimore City, which is just across the line, almost no death sentences in a 25-year period. So, of course, you know, that sort of disparity was part of the unfairness. Some innocent people were freed. That caused it. But for whatever reasons, six states, including Maryland this year, Illinois, and Connecticut the past couple of years, a lot of states are pulling away and not having the death penalty, and more are considering it. Nebraska just took a vote the other day, so there's a lot going on there.
We're talking to Richard Dieter, who's the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. I take it you're rather proud of this recent report. What is the best way for listeners to Execution Watch to access it?
Well, the best way right now is on our website, thedeathpenaltyinfo.org. I can say that we're preparing a more extensive written report that'll have more information, but we decided to release some of the initial data, graphs, and things. So those are all available on our website, and there will be a more extensive report coming out when it's finished.
Can people join or subscribe to the center's work?
Well, it's all free. We have a newsletter that they can sign up, and so they would get this kind of information maybe in a digested form and a way that they could access this. But that's the only thing, that if people sign up for our newsletter, they get it. Otherwise, it's we try to put as much as we can on the website. It's a very expensive. If people want sometimes our written reports, because they cost us to print.
Well, it must. I hear Ferraris in the neighborhood, so it must be a high rent district.
Sorry about that.
What is the exact address of the website?
Okay, it's www.deathpenaltyinfo.org.
www.deathpenaltyinfo.org.
That's right.
So, Richard Dieter?
They'll find right on the homepage some of these graphs about the clustering of the death penalty. There's, the death penalty by county when it comes to executions, the death penalty by county when it comes to who's on death row, who's around the country, and the death penalty by sentencing, at least the most recent sentences. So, there's a lot of, we take it apart a few different ways.
Well, Richard, thank you very much for your work, and thank you for sharing that with Execution Watch. We will continue with the program at this point. Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. That was an interesting conversation. The way Execution Watch actually works is a bunch of folks listening to it being streamed right now. Glad to have your vigilance listening to it. Over the next 24 hours, there will be people all over Europe and indeed the world that will access this program on our website, www.executionwatch.org, or take it off the archive at HD3 channel kpft.org. Now we return to Larry and Mike Gillespie. They have come up to the microphone. What's going on, Mike? Or who's first, Larry?
Well, I'm here to discuss the issue of mental retardation.
Take it.
As you discussed earlier, Ray, the Atkins case and the Briseño case followed this Williams case. And that issue is mental retardation. That is, if Williams is actually eligible to receive the death penalty, the Supreme Court said that mental retarded people cannot receive the death penalty. It's similar to but different from issues of sanity and competency, mm-hmm. which can only handle pretrial as to whether a person has the requisite mental capacity to even be tried, whether he's sane or not.
Larry, these issues go to the level of culpability.
The sanity goes to whether the person has the requisite culpability, mental culpability, to even commit a crime. And then competency as to whether the person can assist his lawyer to even know what's going on. The person can be found mentally, legally culpable, actually be convicted of the crime of capital murder, mm-hmm. but you can't put him to death.
Yeah.
If he's found to be
incompetent.
If he's found to be mentally retarded, Okay, so if the person is found to be mentally retarded, then the Supreme Court in Atkins says you can't put him to death, and then Briseño listed the bases for which you can determine how whether a person is mentally retarded.
Hold a second, Larry. We got a report from Huntsville. Yes, Gloria.
Hi, Ray. Well, the state of Texas has murdered Mr. Williams. The cops are standing up in front of the entrance to the Walls Unit having a press conference. And we are two more closer to hitting 500 executions in this damn state.
And if you wanted to do a press conference, would you have access to the same turf?
If I even walked up to that press conference, I would be arrested.
Okay. I just wanted to point that out to the listening audience, that there is at least a double, probably multiple standards, but a double standard.
Right.
But Jeffrey Damone Williams is now dead.
He is dead. He did not have anybody going to witness his execution.
Jeffrey Damone Williams died alone in that chamber without anyone supporting him.
That's right. And that could have been his decision. Every so often, somebody will not want their family in there, but very rarely. There's about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's about a dozen uniformed officers and a couple of other brothers up at the top of this hill talking to the media. If people in Houston are listening, Mary Benton is up there asking questions and interviewing folks. She's with Channel 2.
See if you can catch her on the way off and give an alternate point of view.
Oh, she's already talked to us.
Okay.
And, you know, this is the second case where a plainclothes cop was killed. The other one was Anthony Haynes' case, and he got a stay last fall.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the police need to review how they do these plainclothes cops with guns and unmarked cars pouncing on people. Seems to be dangerous.
Okay, Gloria. Thank you very much for your work. Be sure and give our regards to the other vigilants.
Okay, and we had one more gentleman join us who lives in Huntsville, and he passed by and saw us and said that he hates execution, and he thinks the state should spend its money elsewhere.
Okay.
So, that put us up to a dozen people here tonight.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And so now, Larry, back to you.
And the way we get here, Ray, to the issue of mental retardation in this case is at the federal writ level, the writ of habeas corpus level on the federal side. The federal district court decided that the issue needed to be looked at as a result of the writ of habeas corpus. And he was actually given an evidentiary hearing where the issue of his retardation was considered. And that hearing lasted for 7 days.
Mercy.
The problem, as Susan has mentioned before, in terms of the retardation issue, is that the Briseño standards are there's got to be a significant sub-average mental ability, IQ, associated with limited adaptive skills, the onset of which has to be before the age of 18. His IQ was about 70, which is really the threshold.
Mm-hmm.
But he graduated from high school
mm-hmm.
on time.
Yeah.
And he had some classes in which he was average, below average, some even above average. He had a couple of jobs. He went to the military. And all of that was before the age of 18, which is really what they look at. So it would have been difficult, I think, to reach the conclusion that he was not retarded.
Yeah.
So he was found not to be retarded, which means he is death eligible, which means he's not restricted from getting.
And I understand as we approach the end of this legislative session, Jim gave me a piece of paper showing that they were going to try to eliminate numbers in the consideration of retardation, which is going to change the paradigm for future cases. And all of that happens at a time when at least we in Harris County are seeing fewer and fewer future cases. There's something going on in this movement that is going to result, I think, in some substantive changes. And I think the Supreme Court's going to get involved when half of the states no longer execute. Then suddenly what is obviously cruel becomes obviously unusual. And that will change the paradigm in the language of the amendment that addresses such things. Let's get Mike Gillespie in here. Mike, you've been assigned a piece of this puzzle as well.
What I've been asked to talk about, which I consider a very critical issue, is a 23-minute delay.
Yeah.
Let's be real fair. Policemen have...
What happened is that the emergency wagon, the meat wagon, the ambulance, was dispatched to the scene where the officer was down. It went to the wrong address, several miles away, and then had to make a correction after it got there. And there is a 23-minute delay on the arrival of an emergency vehicle. And since I am pretty familiar with that neighborhood, the fire station with that vehicle is not too far away from where it needed to go. So 23 minutes is an unusually long time. Now,
the problem is that the dispatcher that day had reported to his superior that he's having hearing problems, and he didn't hear the address. And he gave the wrong address. So we're not talking about something anybody did on purpose. We're talking about something that was happened. The problem with the law is the law says you take people the way they are. When you set into effect an action that causes something, and an act of God stands in the way, you put into effect the movement to cause it. So even though there was a delay, that does not excuse what happened. Now, there's other issues which are interesting. And where I think this comes into is not whether he's guilty of the offense, but whether or not he's a continuing danger to society. Mm-hmm. But let's talk a second about the offense. You know, this concept of did he know he was a police officer is a big issue. And I'm going to tell you, sitting here, I've changed my opinion about it. Before I came here and listened to everybody talk, I started thinking, well, the man had a badge on, the man had a handcuff. What was this boy thinking when he had a handcuff on him? He says he was being robbed. Robbers don't have handcuffs. It must have been a police officer. But then I got to be thinking. He's in plain clothes. He's in a civilian car. Doesn't he have a raid jacket in his car? I mean, he might not be in uniform, but he can have a jacket on, say, police. But what really bothers me is the manner and means of the arrest. I've been doing criminal law almost 40 years. I read police reports all the time. I don't see policemen arguing with defendants. I don't see people getting into a verbal argument with a man with a gun and then
That's what other witnesses reported, that they were in an argument.
And then trying to grab his hand and handcuff him. Police put you down and put you in submission on the ground by gunpoint and then put a knee on your back and handcuff you. I don't think the policemen follow proper procedure. But that gets to be the problem. You can't come into court and attack a police officer.
No.
He's a police officer.
Yeah.
But some interesting things to me, where was he before this happened? Was he truly on duty? Was he... You got to have your game face on. Did he have his game face on? It seems to me that certain things do not follow procedure. The way he went down, the way this man was handcuffed, doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I was concerned, and Mike, are you concerned? There were two confessions. Apparently one that did not include the recognition this guy was a cop, and another one later that did.
Unless they were recorded, I don't know. I can't trust what's put down in these statements. I don't know what he said.
Yeah.
They were recorded. I do not know if I heard they were recorded. I can't talk to that issue because there is confusion. You don't know the questions that were asked. All I'm saying is let that be for a second. Let me change gears right now. We're talking about how difficult it is to come into a court when a man is murdered as a police officer and try to justify it. You can't justify it by blaming the police officer. He's still a police officer. He's got a wife and kids. He's doing his job, and he gets killed.
Yeah.
You can't attack him.
No.
But what you attack is the future dangerousness. And the real issue over here is these 23 minutes. How do you bring this to the attention of the jury without attacking the police officer, attacking the system? Well, another lawyer here made a suggestion. I think it's a good suggestion. What you do is when you get the EMs on the stand and the widows in the audience, just ask the EM, has anybody apologized to this widow for what happened?
Again, and it seemed to be a theme of this particular execution. When you're talking about these trials, there is not some secret, mystic, ethereal point of law that you can reach in a hat and pull out and throw out and win the case. what you're talking about is impressions of the jury, of your client, your performance, the police officers that are testifying against your client. You're talking about pretty jelly stuff. And that is the impressions of the jury. And
exactly.
I can think of another real good reason why I'm glad I'm not a lawyer, is because I like to deal with more tangible things than this jelly stuff.
But there gets to be a time that even though we tell our clients not to take the stand and testify for their own protection,
mm-hmm.
there comes a time when a man is being executed and the question is his future dangerous, that sometimes they need to just talk to the jury. People are smart. People
as a matter of fact, in a recent show, we talked about just blurting out. Remember that?
We did. We did. But there's a lot to be said about a man just talking and the jury listening to his words and getting a feel for him. And I'm not saying it can work, but I do think that sometimes all we have is the ability to connect with the jury, and that defendant sometimes connects better than the lawyer can. As I've also said before, I'm seeing pro se people do very good jobs in court, because they're emotional and connect with the jury and they can relate to what's going on. But, you know, there's another issue here, and the question becomes, how do you present this without attacking? Well, the way to do it, it seems to me, is this 23 minutes is critical.
Yeah.
We have to blame...
It's certainly critical in the officer's life.
We have to blame somebody besides...
Your
we
client.
Have to blame. We can't blame anybody, but we have to show it wasn't our client's fault.
Entirely.
And the most effective way I can think about is two ways. The first way is to have a 23-minute closing, and then show them that's the time period that could have saved his life. Or the second way is to stand there and just for 1 minute watch the clock and say nothing, and let the jury realize how long a minute is, and make them realize 23 of those could be the difference between this man's, and you don't have to say it. They feel it.
Well, in court, as in radio, 1 minute of silence screams.
And that's the point of it. It is an eternity. And times 23, you have to think what would be, and see, like this, you're not attacking anybody.
Okay, Mike, you're filibustering. I want to get Jack Lee in here because he's got a perspective on it. Jack actually knows where this place is. Is that where you meet interesting ladies?
That is a very interesting part of the, it's an interesting part of the Houston. I understand there are, you can go field spotting for ladies of the night in that area.
Okay.
I wanted to...
And it's true. I was right. The fire station is basically right around the corner.
The fire station
on Bel Air.
Is just off of Bel Air.
Yeah, I know where that is.
On a side street, yeah. And the side street takes you right past the CarMax over there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If the ambulance had gone from that station to the address...
It would have been
maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes without traffic. I wanted to touch on something that Mike said about future danger. I think by the actions of Williams, that it's suggestive that he really didn't know this was a police officer, and that perhaps his actions were he really genuinely thought he was being mugged, just as he had mugged somebody else. As a society, we put laws in that protect those who protect us. If an assault on me could be a misdemeanor. The same assault would be a felony because it's assault on a public servant. The problem here is that for an officer not to be wearing uniform and only to be wearing a badge, and on top of all that, to be driving a civilian vehicle. I've seen repo men dressed that way,
mm-hmm.
with a badge mm-hmm. on a chain around their neck. Just because he's got a badge doesn't necessarily mean he's a police officer. And I think it's reasonable to think that Williams didn't know this was a police officer. And in fact, if you look at the there were two recordings that were done. In the first recording, Williams states that he did not know Blando was a police officer. It took the second recording for him to say, well, yeah, he was a police officer. Now, I haven't heard the recording, I haven't seen the trial transcript, but it suggests that perhaps it even he wasn't sure, that Williams wasn't sure if this person was a police officer or not. It's hard to say that if he was going to, if Williams were going to be a future danger, he would have to specifically flaunt authority. And in this case, I don't think we can know that for certain.
Well, we have had a full cast tonight. That's Jack Lee, and you've heard from Mike Gillespie, and you've heard from Mike Douglas, and you've heard from Susan Ashley, and of course, there's Jim Skelton. I don't think we ever leave any of these shows without having questions. And since we're talking about human life, and now it's too late to ask the questions because Jeffrey Damone Williams is dead. He was executed tonight. Questions are basically over. This is a very unique show, and as it evolves and develops, I am fascinated by the evolution. We don't want to do it, but we're going to do it. Sometimes I get involved early by going to Huntsville and interviewing somebody who is scheduled to be executed. One such interview I did recently. And Robert Pruitt is scheduled to be executed. But after talking to Robert, he said an amazing thing. He was an inmate. He's being executed for killing a guard. There is considerable questions whether or not he did it. And in my interview, he said, well, when I first got sentenced to death, I was grateful because it might bring to an early end my suffering. I'll let you think about that and hope we never do a show of Execution Watch on Robert Pruitt. My name is Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. I want to thank Doyle for doing our engineering. Of course, I've got to give my appreciation to Elizabeth, who makes it all happen. She does all the work. I just get to play with the microphone. We owe a lot of gratitude to Otis McClay. He is our wizard that handles all the electronics here. And Victoria Panetti is going to take you out with a wonderful song. And look us all up. We're easily searchable. My name is Ray Hill. Thank you for listening to Execution Watch.